This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Giovanni Batz. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies. And I'm joined here by Director Pamela Yates. But before we begin, can we just give her another round of applause? For So my job as the moderator today is just to kind of just have a conversation with Pamela, and then obviously we'll field some questions if y'all have any questions, dudas, things y'all want to share and reflect, right? So if you see my eyes right now, they're pretty red, and it's because I was like crying for most of this, right? It's just a very emotional documentary, right? So maybe some of y'all are processing things, and that's okay, right? So again, I think it's important to kind of consume this in a way that's positive for each other. Before I start off, I want to thank y'all for taking the time to be here and staying here for this conversation. You know, when I watched this documentary, Borderland, I wanted to put it into historical context, especially for the students that are here today. Pamela Yates' work has been influential in my life, and I know for a lot of folks in the Guatemalan diaspora, Maya folks in diaspora, and folks in exile, right? Diaspora tends to be a very positive term, but a lot of folks were forced out. Our families were forced out as a result of political persecution or economic inequality. So, you know, I really wanted to recognize Pamela's work. I was sharing with Pamela just a couple of minutes ago that there was two films that I think were very formative in my life. As somebody who was born outside of ancestral territories. And that was one, El Norte, right? So Gregory Nava's El Norte, that was like religion, right, for me, because that was the only time I saw somebody who looked like me or those stories on TV, right? So again, this is in 80s, 90s, where people didn't know where Guatemala was, right? So I would tell people that my parents were from Guatemala, and they would say, what part of Mexico is that from, right? Like, so that was, people weren't aware of Central America. And then the second film, of course, was When the Mountains Tremble, which came out in 1983, right? So again, those were two films that I appreciated. El Norte was fiction, of course, right? It's fiction, but based off of things that happen in real life. But When the Mountains Tremble is real, right? And it took, a lot of these scenes took place in the Ishil region. And my work now is in the Ishil region, so every time I watch it, it's just like I take something away from it, right? That was, of course, followed up by Granito, that came out in 2011, if I'm not mistaken, right. And then 500 Years, which came out in 2015. Each of these documentaries I use in my classroom, right? And I think a lot of students definitely resonate with the documentaries. Now, Borderland is the fourth film. We know that those first three films are the trilogy, but this is like an extension of that, right? And in my work, I look at extractive violence and historical displacement of indigenous peoples. And unfortunately, while these documentaries, like When the Mountains Trembles, served as a warning in terms of state-sponsored violence that was being committed against indigenous peoples, that violence continues, right? So the Guatemalan states that peace was, there was peace in 1996. But again, as we saw through Cache's and Francisco's story, the violence continues. And it's very scary, and you know, it's a warning, and you know, you see this documentary, and it's, I don't know if it's just, I'm filled with hope, but I'm also filled with like a lot of pain, and just like, I don't want to fall into fatalism, but it sucks. And the reason why I want to share this, I want to give an update on Cache and Francisco, for instance. So Cache and Francisco, as I mentioned, I met them, I met Cache in Guatemala, I met Francisco at the border. In 2019, I went to Guatemala with my wife and our one-year-old and a half daughter, Ishkanil. It was the first time we were taking Ishkanil to the Ishil region or Guatemala in general. And, you know, I was going back, and we went to the Ishil region, and Cache found out I was going. And he texted me. He's like, hey, I heard you're back in town or whatever. Could I meet you tomorrow? Let's say it was like a Friday. And I was like, hey, like, I really want to, but we have some prior commitments, which was true. Like, we weren't making it up. We just had other, like, commitments with other compañeras y compañeros. But I was like, but I'll hit you up soon, right? A week had passed by and I had to go to a conference abroad. So I was leaving Guatemala and as I was going down the mountain, I was like, oh crap, I forgot to text Cash and I felt bad about it. So I texted him and I was like, hey Cash, like, sorry, like I'm leaving the country, but I'll be back in about like 10 days. So I'll hit you up when I get back. And then I get a text that read, hola, soy la esposa de Cash. Cash se fue al norte. Right, so I'm Gaspar's wife, and he went up north. And the reason why he wanted me to meet with him on a Friday was because he left on a Saturday with Francisco. During that time, I was really worried for him. Like, we didn't know what was going on in that journey. I was very scared for him because I know of other compañeras and compañeros who've done that journey. And, like, you know, it's not good, you know, as you've kind of heard those testimonies. So I was very worried and scared for him. Luckily, Pamela was there. To also kind of accompany him. So I really appreciate Pamela for, again, being concerned about folks, right, and having that empathy. So I really appreciated her also kind of following Kasha's journey. By chance, I got a job in New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. And as soon as I moved there, Kasha arrived to the Cia Juarez, which was like about an hour away. So whether through fate and destiny or just sheer coincidence, I was near Cash. And for 2 years, myself and a group of other compañeras y compañeros, we formed el Grupo de Solidaridad, which included Carlos Spector, the lawyer there, Diego and Salvador, who made cameos there, but there were people who were affiliated with the Catholic Church and NGOs, humanitarian workers, but there was a collective of people who accompanied Francisco and Cash. You know, so as Cash said, like, this world sucks. Like, there are some really terrible people out there, but like through this Grupo de Solidaridad, I didn't fall into fatalism, right? And I was deeply inspired by this collective of people who were there for them, right? And if it wasn't for them, as it was, you know, it would have been a little bit more tough. I remember when Carlos had said, you know, that scene where Cash and Francisco go in to present themselves at the border for the fourth time. Carlos told me that a victory for him, for Cash and Francisco, was for him to take them from Cia Juarez and have them incarcerated here in the U.S. That for him was a legal victory. And that to me is just really twisted, right? Like, how is incarcerating human beings a victory in this system, right? So that was a really rough period. They got out and they lived with me and my family for 2 months. And as y'all saw there, eventually they were able to reunite themselves with their family in Florida. As Carlos had mentioned, sorry, I'm going on, but I wanted to show one last thing just to provide an update with Francisco. As Carlos had mentioned twice in this documentary, both Cash and Francisco have very strong cases. And Francisco had his court date a few months ago, so 5 years after he entered the U.S. I served as an expert witness on his case, right, to demonstrate the country conditions of Guatemala and why somebody like Francisco could suffer death if he were to be deported back to Guatemala. The case was so strong that the government lawyer didn't even question it, and he got asylum. Right. So again, it was that. I don't want to say it was easy, but he represents part of that 2% of Guatemalan nationals who get asylum. So it was that's all he needed, a day in court. And it took 5 years for him to get that day. Cash is still waiting. Cash is still waiting. Cash was supposed to be here today, but La Migra didn't give him permission to come here today. Right. So even though he doesn't have that GPS on his ankle, like, they're still controlling him and his movements to this day, right? So again, la lucha sigue, it's gonna continue. And again, I just really wanted to appreciate Pamela just because I also wanted to appreciate her because she does visibilize indigenous migration, which often tends to get erased when we think about the U.S.-Mexico border, right? So so I just wanted to give Pamela her flowers, you know, and sorry if I'm getting a little emotional, it is like very personal. And thank you. And I guess the first question I wanted to ask Pamela was, you know, 1983, it's like 4 decades since you've been documenting the human rights abuses that have occurred in Guatemala that push people out. So I guess just a basic question, like, how did you end up in Guatemala? And like, how can you reflect on the last 4 documentaries, the last 4 decades? And what message do you have to the younger generations here who may also feel that anger and rage watching injustices we just witnessed right now? So I guess that's the question that I have for you right now.
That's a big question, Giovanni. Yeah. But before that, I wanted to say that one of the great things and one of the beauties of being a documentary filmmaker are the people that I get to meet and be with and have conversations with. And that really applies to you, you know, in the making of this film, because you're not only in the film, but all of the conversations that we had about the making of the film and the editing of the film, because we really try to not be extractivist filmmakers. We really try to collaborate as fully as possible with all the people in the film. And that means not only collaborating while we're producing the film, but also in the post-production process and in showing people cuts of the film before it goes out into the world and the whole world can see it. And so we had a lot of conversations around the cut of the film and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what's ethical, because those are not things that are hard and fast. Those are things that are worked out in conversation and in process. Mm-hmm. But I first went to Guatemala in 1982. I was really angry when I read about the role that the United States played in overthrowing the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz. And I feel like anger can be a really important driver of artistic expression. You know, it's a great way to channel what we're feeling, how our emotions are affecting us, into something that can communicate that emotion, that passion, and also the beauty of our humanity, how it can communicate with one another. So I went to Guatemala to not only research what was going on, but the legacy of the brutal military dictatorships that followed the overthrow of Arbenz. But when I got there, well, first of all, it was really hard because no one would talk to me, because everyone was in such a state of fear. But also, it was very hard in the midst of war to understand what was going on and how I could get people to talk to me. And although that film, When the Mountains Tremble, is very much about the United States' role, what really took over for me was this incredible alliance between indigenous people in the highlands and the urban movement for labor rights and for reform in Guatemala that was so powerful and was really confronting the military dictatorship and was in armed struggle against that dictatorship. So I wanted to tell the story across the whole spectrum of Guatemalan society, from the guerrillas, the armed insurrection, the church, the civil society, and the indigenous population in the highlands. And it was our first film, so we shot the whole film. Tom Siegel was the cinematographer, I was the sound recordist, it was just the two of us. And we came back to New York and we had a lot of really great sequences, but nothing to really hold the film together. And that's when someone brought Rigoberta Menchú to our studio in New York, because she was trying to talk to delegates at the General Assembly at the United Nations, and our studio was across town in Manhattan. And when I met her, she was an extraordinary person. She was a leader even then at 22 years old. And I did a traditional interview with her, but then we thought, let's do something really different, because she's not in Guatemala, and the whole rest of the film takes place in Guatemala. So what if we put her, or what if we envision something different? And first, we invited her into our editing room, and she looked at all the sequences, and she said, I could write my story, and I could connect the different sequences you have in the film. So she wrote her story and connected all the different sequences in the film, and then we took her into a studio in New York in a limbo space where she speaks directly to the camera. In 1982, people in documentary films didn't speak directly to the camera. They were always speaking to somebody. who was then interpreting them for the rest of the audience. But she spoke, we wanted her to speak directly to the camera, and she wanted to speak directly to the camera. And that became, I believe, part of the power of When the Mountains Tremble, that she was a person that told her own story. And it's really funny because I look back now at like the reviews of the time. The New York Times trashed the film. They called her a poor Indian girl. They didn't even say her name. And 10 years later, Wurugarecta Menchu, of course, went on to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was the first indigenous person to be awarded that prize. And at that time, she was the youngest person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I spoke, when I introduced the film and I talked about a journey of discovery, well, that was really it. You know, rather than like panicking that we didn't have a film, how can we turn our greatest weakness into a strength? This is something that we didn't have, but when it was presented to us, we immediately saw that she could be the one to tell the story, her story, the story, and lead that. But I guess fast forwarding 40 years, the thing that she taught me was about true collaboration, because she demanded it, and I understood it. And so we went forward and took the film out into the world, which helped put her on the world stage, along with many other things, her tireless advocacy, her autobiography. But over the course of making the other films, too, I think that I came to realize that it's only, if you really want to make change, you have to have a long-term commitment. You have to have a lifelong commitment to social change. And I think that's the story that we tell in Granito, too. Each of us have a granito de arena, a tiny grain of sand to contribute to positive social change. And what is that? What is our granito de arena? And how can we carry that forward? That, as well as staying connected to people and places where we've made films in the past. Maybe not to make another film, but just to stay connected. So whether you're a filmmaker or an archaeologist or an anthropologist or a lawyer or a professor, you can still stay connected to people and places where you've done work, where you've done work together, where you've collaborated. Because even when human rights violations are being committed and we feel impotent to stop them, it's still important to document them because you never know how they're going to be used in the future. And in our case, what we documented in When the Mountains Tremble was then used as key forensic evidence in the genocide case. And this was material that didn't even make it into that film. This was material in our outtakes that we had saved and then went back 25 years later, a quarter century later, and found this inculpatory material that helped convict Efraim Briosmont. So those are just some of, you know, the life lessons and sharing of our experiences as documentary filmmakers.
Yeah, and one thing I definitely appreciate about this documentary is that it was very, like, well-balanced. Like, you see a chorus of voices, right? So you have activists, you have academics, you have lawyers, migrantes, obviously, who are taking charge of their political agency and fighting for a different tomorrow. But very, you know, the footage there is very, like, really incredible. So I don't know if you could speak to how you were able to, como un acercamiento, how you were able to kind of reach out to some of these actors, like what was the process of like recruiting folks for the documentary, and also some of the footage that they used, like for instance, the raiding of that camp. My understanding is there was like a FOIA involved, so I don't know if you could kind of discuss that in terms of how that process was.
Really, it's about building trust with people. So I met Gabriela Castañeda very early on in the process because she was a communications manager or director at the Border Network for Human Rights. And Gabriela was always incredible. I mean, she was a great communicator. She was a fronteriza, you know, a border resident. And I mean that in the sense that border residents speak Spanish and English not only fluently, but fluidly. They switch from one to the other. You should try it sometime. I've tried it. It's really hard. But they do it effortlessly. And just the culture on the border is so distinct. It's one of the most, it's a really rich culture in the United States. And she was the embodiment of that. And even though she considers herself Mexican, she's really American too. And that's the characteristic of a fronteriza. And of course, Kash, I never really envisioned him being in the film. And when he texted me that he was coming to the United States and I tried to dissuade him, I wanted to be there and to try to do everything I could to keep him safe. But slowly it dawned on me that he, you know, was, his story was one of thousands of people's stories. And, you know, I really encouraged him to write his story as well as record it, because he's a beautiful writer. And he would have 2, 3, 4 days in safe houses waiting to go to the next leg of the journey. Mm-hmm. And rather than be bored, I thought he could write on his phone and he could WhatsApp it to me. I think we have about 3,000 WhatsApp messages from that trip. And then the whole process of being part of the Grupo de Solidaridad and trying to help. I wanted to be able to follow the money of mm-hmm. the border industrial complex, but I didn't really know how I was going to do it. So I was researching online when I met the people from the XP Method project, mm-hmm. the digital humanists, and they were at Columbia. So I emailed them, and Alex Gil invited Paco and me up for lunch, and an hour lunch turned into like 5 hours of talking. And then they agreed to you know, be part of the film. And we filmed all of that in a day and a half. Mm-hmm. And it's unscripted. It's basically the talk that they give. And then to your point about the raid, so Luis Osuna, I already knew him because I had walked in the desert with him looking for people. He was part of the Armadillo search and rescue. And I knew that he was going to be volunteering for No More Deaths that summer. So when I heard about the raid, I tried to call him. But his phone had been taken, and they didn't ever get their phones back. So I tracked him down through other people, and finally he called me, and he told me he had been at the raid. And Luis is a filmmaker now, and at that time he was a film student. And he said, and you know, there was a guy there that came with the Border Patrol tactical unit, and he had a professional camera and like a Steadicam rig, and my friend took a photograph of it, and he uploaded it before they took our phones. So I said, wow, can I get that photograph? He sent me the photograph, and I thought, why are they filming a raid? It was before the 2020 elections. I thought maybe they were going to use it in one of the Trump campaign ads. So I tried to get the footage, couldn't get the footage, and I asked around and got a pro bono lawyer who specializes in the Freedom of Information Act from the American Immigration Council. And she and I worked together, and she made the request, and they said, no, we don't have the footage. And she said, but here's a picture of your cameraman with the Steadicam rig, and it looks like you actually did film this. And so they hemmed and hawed, and we had to make a lawsuit, Skylight versus the Department of Homeland Security, kind of scary. And after 2 years, they gave us the footage. They had the footage, they gave it to us, and now the footage is open and available for anyone to use. But it makes you wonder, what other footage is there and mm-hmm. what other footage is available? Yeah. Alex Hill says that students should file one Freedom of Information Act request every year. That it would be a great contribution to civil society if we could find out a lot more than we know. Mm-hmm. But those are just some of the things that are really important to do in making a film. And, mm-hmm. and I think the most important one, though, is how do you build relationships of trust? And in documentary filmmaking, access is everything. But what's really key is emotional access. Like, are you going to let me into what you think and feel? Mm-hmm. And am I going to earn that privilege mm-hmm. from you to be able to do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I'll vouch for Pamela, because, like, sometimes when we would have conversations, like, I was very honest in terms of, like, how I was thinking about things, and she was always listening, and we always engaged and stuff like that. So I always appreciated having that conversation with Pamela. So again, I even watching like previous versions of this and kind of giving my notes and stuff like that. So I definitely appreciated that. You know, you had just mentioned that there was the elections in 2020. Obviously, in November, there's going to be another election. And from my understanding, this is part of the Abrazos tour, right? So it's like a 20-plus city tour where you're going
26
screenings that you're all doing, different locations. But what's been the reaction of Borderland in the communities that you visited, or like what are the conversations, like what are some of the discussions that emerge from after showing this screening? Has there been any like backlash, or are people supportive? I'm just kind of curious, like kind of what the reaction has been to this documentary.
You know, I learned so much from the audience reaction to things. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's chewing my food and not swallowing it if we don't go out with the film and engage with people and see what they think. Mm-hmm. And I've been really gratified to see that when we show the film, most people stay for the whole film and they stay afterwards to want to talk about the film. Mm-hmm. And that is where we really get that kind of feedback is really important for us. Mm-hmm. Because film is an emotional medium. And so if you're emotionally engaged in the story, it means that you're going to take it the next step. I think what most audiences have wanted to know is, what can we do? Mm-hmm. How can we act? Mm-hmm. And I always say, first of all, the fact that you came here tonight to see the film, you've already acted. And then we talk about, you know, various ways you can act and how you can engage with local immigrant rights groups. But people really want to know that. There have been screenings where people want to get up and, you know, hear their own voice. They don't agree with the film. They don't think that the film is factual. You know, there's a kind of tendency now that the facts are whatever you decide you want them to be. But actually, we're really, really rigorous about the facts in our film. Mm-hmm. And even a film like this, we will do an independent fact check for. Because we don't really need to overblow the facts. The facts are there, and they're really damning, mm-hmm. especially around the border industrial complex. Mm-hmm. So there always are people. There are people sometimes that get up and want to just speak their mind and don't really have a question. So, you know, we try to get a conversation going and make sure that everybody who wants to ask a question can. A lot of times we get kicked out of the cinemas. I mean, not because we're getting kicked out, but because the conversation keeps going and we overstayed and the next film is about to start. And in Tucson, we were, they tried to kick us out of the theater, and we were trying to help the theater manager steer people into the lobby, but they wouldn't go into the lobby. And they had to start the next film and turn the sound up loud to get us out. Yeah. So that was very, you know, that's really good to know. That's what we make the films for, you know. Mm-hmm. We make the films so people can internalize them and go out and act. We also make the films to introduce people to people you might not come across in mm-hmm. your life. Sometimes I think society really separates us, and we don't have the tools to go out and be proximate to the kinds of struggles that are at the center of our national conversation around immigration, for example. Mm-hmm. So we want audiences to come and feel like they've gotten to know Kash and Gabriela and Giovanni and the digital humanists.
Yeah, and just to let y'all know, there's a study guide that should be publicly available that's going to accompany the documentary. So if you want to screen this in your classrooms, and UCSB should definitely purchase the film, right? Like, we got to do that. But there, from my understanding, there's going to be a study guide that's going to be available soon. And in that study guide, that's going to provide educators tools to teach their students on different topics like Maya migration, U.S. Border policies. And then towards the end of that guide, there's going to be the section of like how you could get involved with different community and local organizations. So that should be forthcoming, from my understanding. I don't know if you could mention the website and where people could like learn more about the documentary and access these kind of additional resources.
Yeah, it's borderland.skylight.is. So borderland.skylight.is. Okay, on that microsite, which is part of our website, you can also see there's a tab that says host a screening. So outside of academia, well, in academia, but outside of academia too, if you have a church group or a community group or a language study group, whatever, we make it very easy for you to host a screening of the film and make it available. Yeah. So the film is, you know, out and open, and we want people to be able to use it and access it. We really want people to, immigrant rights organizations, to use it to strengthen their work. The work that they're already doing. And some organizations also use it to as a fundraiser for their organization, and we're happy to provide the film for them to do that.
Right. Well, I think on that note, if it's okay, like if we could just open it up for Q&A, and you've already been warned, don't be that audience member. Just kidding. I'm just kidding, just teasing. But yeah, so we want to open it up for conversation. Obviously, if you have any points of reflections, questions that y'all want to ask Pamela or myself, this is the space to do it. So I believe there's a microphone somewhere, right?
Well, first of all, amazing, amazing work, both in advocacy and in art. This is the first CWC screening I actually came out to deliberately, because it's said that you are a human rights activist and a documentarian, which is ultimately my aspiration.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an activist myself, and I'm a sociology and film major here. And I love video filmmaking, video creating. So I deliberately really wanted to come out here and be able to get to talk, get the chance to talk to you. So amazing work, incredibly emotional. I teared up in the middle of it too. I was really interested in the creative process of this film, and I wanted to ask about the thought process or the collaboration process behind some deliberate decisions you made, like cinematically or like artistically in the film. And then this question is twofold. I'm also curious about how you planned out or mapped out the timing and the organizing like a timeline for the film, like from the conception of it towards the end, because like this is a story that is still developing. So like when did you feel like was a good idea to like publish it and like ultimately like end it, and like what were you like imagining, and like, or like how did that look like toward in the beginning of that process? Yeah, I hope that was clear what my question was.
Thank you for that. I think it's really important when you're making, you're telling these kinds of stories, to be sure that you approach it from a cinematic perspective. That you use the beauty and the power of cinema and cinematic expression to connect our humanity. And so in this film, I worked with Juan Hernandez. He's a cinematographer from Hermosillo, Sonora. So 4 or 5 hours from the border, driving, very close to the border. And together we devised the look for the film, which was, at that time, it wasn't well known or much used in documentary, the 2:3:9 aspect ratio, which is, for those of you who aren't cinema students, there, it's the aspect ratio, which is much more like CinemaScope. And we wanted to do that because we felt like the story we were telling was an epic story. And so we wanted to bring that to the understanding of the storytelling itself. We only use prime lenses. So prime lenses are fixed focal lengths. They're not zoom lenses. So even though it takes you a little bit longer to do everything, it gives you a kind of a cinema look that's much more associated with dramatic films. And actually, that's been a hallmark of our work ever since When the Mountains Tremble. How do you borrow from fiction filmmaking and the power along that goes along with fiction filmmaking and still make a documentary film without overly controlling the documentary film? Because so much of documentary films, things happen that you couldn't have predicted, and you have to be able to film them. So those were, you know, some of the decisions that went into it. Another hallmark is close up on faces, because I believe that one of the most beautiful panoramas of filmmaking is the geography of the human face. And so when you see the human face in close up, and the person is looking directly at the camera, it creates a connection between that person and the public that you don't get otherwise. And what was the second part of your question?
The timing of like, how do you...
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, whatever timing I started the film out with, I had to throw up in the air because of the pandemic. The pandemic really upset everything. But remember I was talking about how you'd have to turn your weakness into a strength? So I tried to turn that weakness into having, for example, weekly phone calls with Gabriela, and I would always record our Zoom calls. You know, but that because we were so isolated during the pandemic, that created a relationship of trust, much deeper than we had before. You know, the stories always start before you make the film, and they always continue after you finish the film. So at a certain point, you have to stop telling the story, even though the story continues. And I'm really glad that I let the film go, that we filmed, we continued to film after the pandemic. Because if it had, you know, been mired in the pandemic, I don't think it would have had the forward trajectory that we really want the film to do. Because that's what you want. You want at the end of the film, the audience knows that the story continues. So you want the people in the film to, and your storytelling to have that forward trajectory. Because then it takes the emotions like out of the movie theater and into real life. And that's what we want. And then the other thing is, I never want to, okay, even in the darkest moments, there are always people finding a way forward. And so who are those people? And those are the people I'm always looking for, and those are the people who are the protagonists in the film, like Giovanni.
I'm curious, I don't even know if how to ask this exactly, but I always go to the Santa Barbara International Film Festival for like 15 years.
Really?
And yeah, and you've talked about presenting your film, you know, in yourself, taking it to communities. And do you ever take your movie to the film, like the whole film festival circuit thing with any of your movies or?
Yeah, part of the 26 cities, some are film festivals as well. Like we're in El Paso Film Festival. Tomorrow we're going to the Mill Valley Film Festival. We were at the Ashland Film Festival. We're going to the Woodstock Film Festival. So it's a combination of film festivals, academic screenings, and art house cinemas in cities. You know.
Well, I would think that Roger Durling at Santa Barbara International would be really interested in your movie. I don't know if you've talked to him. But
yeah, I think that's in January, right?
I think it's going to be in February this coming year. I've
February
already got my
this
tickets.
Year. Yeah. I'll make a point of talking to them. Thank you.
I recommend that.
Yeah, okay.
Hi, just wanted to say thank you for very much like putting in the effort and work to make this documentary. I know like that takes a lot of like emotional and physical labor to create something as like intense as like the narrative you're basically creating here. But like just more so on like my personal relation with what was shown is that like a lot of this does bring like really intense emotions for me because like 2019 my dad was detained by ICE, put in a detention center for 2 months in Otay Mesa, the one near San Diego. You could see into Mexico from over there, and I still remember like how very dehumanizing it is to enter those institutions and wait for like your father to come out. But like even more so bringing that more into the present, I can't help but make the connection to like this intense violence that migrants face to what Palestinians experience in Gaza with like the very high-tech surveillance system provided by the Israeli government and that is funded by them, and which is also brought over here with Elbit Systems contracting for the U.S. border. And like I can't help but make that connection, like, and that's just like me like saying my own personal reflections, but like in more so the international side of it, does that problem, or not so much problem, but does that ever arise in the process of the filmmaking, like the larger implications?
Yes, very much so. But I think you have to decide like what is the story you're gonna tell. You know, because you want the films to catalyze those kinds of discussions, but maybe you can't put it all into the film. Sometimes I look at my first film and I feel like I try to put everything into it, and I wasn't sure if I was ever going to make another film again. So I wanted to put everything into it. But I really feel like I could have put a lot more about Guatemala into this film. And I could have put a lot more about the history of immigration in the United States and the history of exclusion, or, you know, the violent history of immigration into this film. I wanted to put into this film, I always feel like Americans don't know why people are coming here. And I wanted to put a lot more of the backstory about why people are, what the United States did in those countries, and why people are coming here as a result of that. But I couldn't put it into that film. And the same with many of the things that are happening in our world today that really are connected. As you said, what's happening in Palestine. I would also say mass incarceration in this country. It's a mass incarceration and the mass incarceration complex system is like a first cousin to the border industrial complex. So, but you know what? Go out and continue to make those films. You know, write that book, write that article. Very necessary.
La lucha sigue. No, I think I just really want to appreciate everyone, because it is getting late, and I'm sure people are tired emotionally.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.